The newest book by journalist Naomi Klein is The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalists. She explains the horrifying circumstances that Puerto Ricans have been living with every day since Hurricane Maria battered the island in September 2017. And she details the battle being waged by disaster capitalists to remake the island as a paradise for the wealthy while relocating the middle class and poor to Florida. She does this as a recent Harvard study places the death toll of this natural disaster at 70 times higher than the official count of 64 to a shocking 4,645 people. We are joined right now by Naomi Klein and by Elizabeth Jean-Pierre, Executive Director of UpRose and Co-Chair of the Climate Justice Alliance. First of all, thank you to you both for joining us.
Thanks, Marie. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I mean, this first question is really open. It's for the both of you. You both visited the island recently. How would you describe the recovery 8 months on?
Well, I would say that I had a mixed impression. There was an enormous amount of work being done by people on the island with limited resources, just the people-to-people, just recovery, where people were engaged in farming and taking care of each other's health and looking out for each other and organizing, and that was a beautiful and powerful thing to see. And the other part of that was going through a highway with all the lights off in the middle of the night and seeing destruction everywhere, seeing poles that were hanging, trees that had limbs that were in a precarious situation. So the physical infrastructure really sent a message that recovery had not started. And then we saw long lines of people waiting for water, for single serving bottles of water from the Red Cross. So there was a lot that we saw, and it was really sort of a combination of neglect from the side of government and from renewed strength from people in Puerto Rico who were basically saying, well, if government is not here for us, we need to be here for each other. At least that's the way that I experienced it.
Naomi?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Elizabeth puts it so well, that there are just so many examples of people stepping into this vacuum left by abandonment by the state at every level. And I think something else that really needs to be remembered is that it isn't just about responding to the disaster of Hurricane Maria, and I'm not even sure it's primarily about that. There is this layering of multiple disasters going on where a great deal of what people are dealing with this so-called reconstruction is the disaster of economic austerity, right? That is why it has taken so long to get the electricity back up and running, and why even after electricity has been reconnected, there are then blackouts and threats of more blackouts. There was a disaster before the disaster, which was this more than decade-long program of the most brutal economic austerity, the pretext for which was caused by Puerto Rico's so-called debt crisis. It also long predates that. I mean, you could date it back to the beginning of colonization. But I think that so many of the challenges have to do with the way Puerto Rico was so systematically starved and really strangled economically before Maria hit, and is being strangled still.
Naomi, you've said that you keep thinking about this phrase from four decades ago by the great late investigative journalist Rodolfo Walsh, the Argentinian kind of inventor of investigative journalists. When he was describing the economic policies of Argentina's military junta, he called it, quote, planned misery. Do you think what's going on in Puerto Rico right now is planned misery? Do you believe it's the intention of the government to make poorer Puerto Ricans so miserable that they'll move to Florida?
That phrase really haunts me, planned misery. What Rodolfo Walsh was describing was the economic program of this brutal military regime, which was really a plan to redistribute wealth upwards. And I think that, frankly, a whole lot of the world has been under a program of planned misery for the last 40 years as public services have been systematically strangled, and there's been a parallel process of militarization and criminalization of the poor and overwhelmingly of people of color. But Puerto Rico has received this, you know, as I said earlier, this really, really heavy dose of it since the debt crisis. And, you know, I think Elizabeth can speak much better than me to how this is playing out in terms of a program of depopulation.
Yeah, thank you, Naomi. And you know, I actually don't think we even have to look to Latin America for stories about Puerto Rico has its own stories, and depopulation started long ago in order to support disaster capitalism. If you look at the policies of Muñoz Marín and you look at Operation Bootstrap and you look at the efforts actually to get rid of what they called excess population, they literally moved people out. They destroyed the agricultural sector to create spaces for petrochemical industries and for other U.S. corporate interests. It's happened before in Puerto Rico, and it's happening again. And so before the hurricane hit, there had already been, because of austerity, because of neglect, because of colonialism, there had already been over 100,000 Puerto Ricans who had moved out of Puerto Rico, many moving into Central Florida. And so on top of that, the fact that we knew that the storm was coming, we knew that we had experienced Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and we knew that Puerto Rico was vulnerable and susceptible, and vulnerable in large part not just because of the history of neglect and austerity, but also because of the environmental abuses that exist in Puerto Rico that are due in large part to U.S. corporate interests, like the 23 superfunds that we have in Puerto Rico. So nothing was done to protect people from exposure to those chemicals and to those toxics and toxicants. Nothing was done to make Puerto Rico climate adaptable and to prepare it. And so on top of the climate disaster, we have this economic reality that was created just to support U.S. economic interests and really depends on emptying out the island. And so now we're seeing people leaving in droves, and we're seeing a lot of young people, like a brain drain, leaving from Puerto Rico. And that, I feel, and a lot of people in our community feel, is quite intentional. It's not new, and the storm has become an opportunity to do that to the island, to basically empty it out and create opportunities for disaster capitalists.
Elizabeth, you mentioned disaster capitalism. Naomi, I'd like, first of all, if you could define that for the listeners, but also, you know, you write about a pitched battle between wealthy investors, particularly from the technology industry, and everyday Puerto Ricans fighting for a place in their island's future. Who are some of the major players, the technology players, that are trying to get a foothold in Puerto Rico in the wake of a disaster like this?
Sure. Well, you know, I think disaster capitalists are just what they sound like. You know, they're people who see dollar signs in the midst of misery. I mean, Donald Trump just gave us a pretty classic example of what I mean by the term when he talked about how what he thinks of when he sees North Korea firing cannons into the sea. He sees a great real estate opportunity in the beaches below. I mean, look, some people's brains are just hardwired in this way where even in the most, you know, extreme threat and misery, they see this opportunity. So, you know, I started using the phrase disaster capitalism when I was covering the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when you had this swarm of U.S. contractors who saw the rebuilding of Iraq as something that they could really exploit for huge private gain. There was, you know, anybody who remembers that period remembers just the enormous inefficiencies, corruption, and just they were not getting the job done. But you had companies like Halliburton and Bechdel and Fluor just, get Blackwater getting tremendously rich in that period. But It's more than just the sort of immediate kind of profiteering from disaster. It's also imagining disaster zones as a kind of a blank slate or a blank canvas, to quote Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosello. He came to New York a couple of months ago and spoke to potential investors, trying to entice them to come to Puerto Rico, and saying it's like a blank canvas. And really what he means by that, and what is always meant by that really harrowing phrase, is you know, the people are out of the way, have been swept out of the way, that the state of emergency and the need to focus on those daily needs of staying alive, as Elizabeth mentioned, people are still waiting in lines for water and food. In moments like that, it's harder to be involved in, you know, affairs of state, you know, in self-determination. And so this is seen as an opportunity, and there is this push that once again predates Maria. It's really a population replacement program, right? Elizabeth was talking about people being moved out of Puerto Rico, but there's also this parallel process of trying to replace that population with so-called, you know, high net worth individuals from the tech sector, from the financial sector, to lure them to Puerto Rico with just the most incredible set of tax breaks and tax holidays. These are non-Puerto Ricans who are being lured there to change, you know, their addresses for their Bitcoin companies. These are sort of very light footprint companies that really only need access to data to do their business. And you know, some of them are calling themselves Portopians. And you know, there's a guy named Brock Pierce, who's sort of the guru of the cryptocurrency crowd. And Elizabeth mentioned the brain drain. Well, Brock Pierce counters with the idea that he and his friends represent a brain gain for Puerto Rico. So they're quite explicit that this is a population replacement program, and they want to come in, they want to set up their kind of Bitcoin libertarian utopia. What is drawing them to Puerto Rico is the fact that they wouldn't pay federal income tax, and that there are Puerto Rican laws that mean that they won't have to pay any tax on capital gains, interest. So, you know, it's a really desirable place if that's what you're looking for.
I mean, what's the... Sorry, Elizabeth, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that it isn't even the traditional disaster capitalist. It's gone actually beyond that, because it is a climate disaster. And so we're also seeing, you know, companies like Elon Musk, who would be interested in privatizing the grid in Puerto Rico, and it would then again, you know, it could solve the problem of sustainability and energy, but it doesn't solve the problem of the fact that it's still U.S. owned, and that the United States really controls access to electricity, and that it's not Puerto Rican owned. You're seeing environmentalists that are going into, and I'm an environmental justice, climate justice activist, but you're seeing mainstream big green organizations going into Puerto Rico to buy large tracts of land for conservation, because they think that that's important without responding to what people on the island are saying is important. And so they're coming in and helicoptering in with their own agendas. And you're seeing a lot of folks that are basically believe in terms of how to work in Puerto Rico and deepening our colonization and being contemporary missionaries, then working in a way that supports what people on the island are saying that they need. And people on the island have the solutions. They know exactly what they need to do. They're involved in a number of initiatives that are really about regenerative energy, food sovereignty. They are engaged in moving away from fossil fuel extraction and moving towards sovereignty. And those are the things that people who really believe in justice would be investing in. But instead, there are people that see the disaster in Puerto Rico as an opportunity. And so it goes beyond the usual big corporations. It's actually a wide range of institutions and people, gentrifiers, folks that are pushing us out of our communities in New York City, are looking at the housing stock in Puerto Rico and thinking that that's an opportunity for them. For me as a Puerto Rican, that's also considered disaster capitalism. So it is so broad and so huge and so overwhelming, and it all comes with really doing doing it at the expense of the suffering that people in Puerto Rico are enduring. So I just wanted to share that because I don't want us to talk about it in terms of just the big corporations. It's even folks that should be our allies.
I'm Hari Kundabola. I'm speaking with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalist, along with Elizabeth Jean-Pierre, Executive Director of UpRose and co-chair of the Climate Justice Alliance. Welcome back. I'm Hari Kundabola. I'm speaking with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalist, along with Elizabeth Jean-Pierre, Executive Director of UpRose and co-chair of the Climate Justice Alliance. Before the break, we were talking about people who should be groups who should be allies to Puerto Ricans actually serving the interests of corporations. What is the position of the Puerto Rican government on some of the privatization schemes that have been proposed?
Naomi, I don't know if you want to answer that. I can just say quickly that there is an aggressive plan to privatize communications, the education system, transportation infrastructure, the electrical grid. Literally, it feels as though the entire island and all of its infrastructure is being privatized. But Naomi, you may want to add to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fair to say that there is really a united front between the governor's office, between Ricardo Oroseo's office, and the Fiscal Control Board, which is the board that was appointed by Congress. And it's always worth reminding people that Puerto Ricans don't have an elected representative in Congress, but Congress was able to appoint seven people to this Fiscal Control Board that makes all major economic decisions for Puerto Rico. So the message from the governor's office and the message from the Fiscal Control Board has been pretty united that before Maria and afterwards, and it has been this relentless push for economic austerity, for huge cutbacks. Thousands of Puerto Ricans, tens of thousands of Puerto Rican public sector workers have already been laid off. There were plans to cut the budget of the University of Puerto Rico in half. Hundreds of schools had already been closed down before Maria, and then after Maria, the governor's office came out with a fiscal plan that he submitted to the Fiscal Control Board, and that called for closing 300 additional schools and opening up the school system to privatization. The Secretary of Education has talked openly about learning from what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Hurricane Katrina, after which New Orleans became the most privatized school system in the United States, where teachers were fired overnight, schools shut down and reopened as charters. That said, there are certainly voices against privatization, like the mayor of San Juan. Carmen Yulín Cruz has been, I think, very supportive of the movements that have been resisting disaster capitalism and has pushed back against the governor when he announced the privatized plans to privatize the electricity system.
I want to read a blurb by Carmen Yulín Cruz, mayor of San Juan, that is in your book, Naomi. "We are in a fight for our lives. Hurricanes Irma and Maria unmasked the colonialism we face in Puerto Rico and the inequality it fosters, creating a fierce humanitarian crisis. Now we must find a path forward to equality and sustainability, a path driven by communities, not investors. And this book explains, with careful and unbiased reporting, only the efforts of our community activists can answer the paramount question, what type of society do we want to become and who is Puerto Rico for?" Now, we talked about the governor definitely not working, it seems like, in the interests of the community. Does he still enjoy the support of the people?
I think Elizabeth should answer that. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that I think he's helped organize. That's what he's done. He's basically created a groundswell of people that are now uniting and asking for sovereignty. They don't trust him. What I understand is that his father was the creator of PROMESA, They don't trust his policies. They don't trust his competence. A lot of the comments that we often hear have to do with his competence, the fact that he wasn't prepared to be governor, that he was just an entitled privileged puppet that was put in that position, and that there are a lot of basic questions that his administration has been unable to answer. So, for example, the huge discrepancy between the number 64 and the number 4,645 of people dead in Puerto Rico and growing, that in itself has raised so many questions about the competency and the intentions of his administration to actually provide people with accurate information. And so there is no trust in his administration, and the few people who support him are people who have always been, right of center, and who are probably doing better off than most folks in Puerto Rico. And that is something that is also felt by the Puerto Rican diaspora in the United States. So there's a little trust. When he came to New York City, there was a protest in the Bronx. There's very little support as far as we know for his administration, because under his administration, not only did Promesa take hold, but we now have this disaster, and it's been managed in the worst way possible.
I'd like
he was meeting with the president and saying that things were okay while people were dying. So it's pretty staggering how poorly he's managed this.
I'd like to talk about the death toll, which we talked about in the beginning of this interview, and the fact that the official count is 64, and a Harvard study placed it at 4,645. people, and we've heard, it could be as big as 5,700, since the study only covered a 3-month window. Why is the Puerto Rican government not being transparent about the number of actual deaths? And also, I'm assuming this doesn't also include the people dying because of power plants blowing up and catching fire, or structures falling and hitting people, or the incredible suicide rate. Why is the government not making an effort to be transparent about the number of actual deaths?
Well, I think it does include that. The way they did the study was comparing it with what had been reported in previous years. So these numbers represent, and it's a horrible phrase, but they represent what they call excess deaths, right? So they represent just the higher number of deaths in this period. So they would encompass the suicides. They would encompass the people who died directly as a result of Maria, like high storms, power plants blowing up. But it's very clear from the study that the main contributor to that larger number is the collapse of the infrastructure, and particularly the healthcare system. And perhaps that's why there has been such an unwillingness to audit these deaths. And, Elizabeth and the organizations she leads have been calling for an audit of those deaths, an audit of the debt, because they're interrelated, right? Because you don't have a total system breakdown of the electricity grid, the water system, the transportation system, unless they had been systematically starved. So I think what we're really seeing here is just the death toll of austerity.
Mm-hmm. I'm Hari Kondabolu. Yeah, hey. I'm speaking with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalist, along with Elizabeth Jean-Pierre, Executive Director of UPROSE and Co-Chair of the Climate Justice Alliance. Elizabeth, I think you were about to say something.
Yeah, no, I was going to agree with Naomi and say that, the issue of Puerto Rico's status as a U.S. territory can't be divorced from the emergency response and the recovery initiatives, that Puerto Rico's status is one of the root causes that left Puerto Rico with this crippling debt and crumbling infrastructure. And so by being able to talk about the number of people that actually died is to put attention on the fact that the system that they've created has led us to this. And even now as we speak, it's more than 8 months out, the morgues are packed with bodies of loved ones, of families. That's still happening. And it's really important, as you noted, that number only reflects the first 3 months, and we're 8 months out. So some of us think that the number may be as high as 8,500, even 10,000, I hope not. But so I think a lot of this is really related to this situation that put us here in the first place.
Naomi, I want to just get to kind of the big players who are right now trying to capitalize from the suffering in Puerto Rico. Who are some of the entrepreneurs and financiers that are trying to get a foothold in Puerto Rico? I know that, you know, you mentioned a couple of people previously, like Brock Pierce.
Right. You know, and the crypto crowd, and some of these are quite small players who have moved their small cryptocurrency company and, you know, sort of banded together with this idea of maybe buying a very large piece of land and building a crypto city. All the big private power companies are eyeing Puerto Rico, and as Elizabeth said, that includes companies like Tesla. They may have a different model for the kind of power they want to bring, but all of them, are coming up with these schemes without direct input from Puerto Ricans. It's just backroom dealings. There has been very, very little transparency. And, you know, there's the charter school complex, right? Very connected to Betsy DeVos and her agenda, private school agenda and charter school past. Then you have transportation companies that are eyeing the privatization of Puerto Rico's ferry system. There's a lot of concerns that there's going to be more privatized highways. These are just some of the players. But as Elizabeth noted, I mean, it isn't only what we would think of as for-profit companies that see in Puerto Rico this kind of laboratory. It's also the NGO complex as well.
We mentioned New Orleans briefly. How similar is it to what happened in New Orleans?
I would say that there are a number of similarities, and Naomi, please add to this. You've been studying this, but the Climate Justice Alliance has members in New Orleans, and you know what we see is that FEMA is currently pushing policies to promote relocation rather than rebuilding in Puerto Rico. Same thing happens in New Orleans. There are people from New Orleans, historical Black communities, that now live, surprisingly, in Houston, where they were hit by Hurricane Harvey just recently, and have never been brought back to New Orleans, and now those communities that they lived in for years are now being promoted as places for pioneers to move into. They have environmental and transportation amenities they never had before in communities that desperately needed them for many, many years. And so I think that FEMA played the role is playing the role in Puerto Rico, instead of rebuilding, is pushing us out. Same thing they did in New Orleans. Privatization of the schools. You know, all of a sudden you saw a complete overhaul of the school system, and a number of schools turned into charter schools in New Orleans. And the list is long, but I'll let Naomi add to that.
Well, there are definitely parallels, and there are also these, you know, really important people-to-people grassroots exchanges going on that Elizabeth's organizations have been a part of, and that we saw some of in action when we were both in Puerto Rico, where you had folks exchanging those lived experiences, sharing strategies. There have been quite a few Puerto Ricans who I know who have traveled to New Orleans in the past few months to talk to educators, parents, about how, you know, what they would have done differently to try to stop the privatization of their school system, providing real tangible solidarity. Honestly, the biggest difference that I see is that, you know, in New Orleans, there was a total evacuation of the city, right? And where people were given one-way tickets out of New Orleans, and, you know, they were spread, you know, through every state. And so the privatization of the school system and the bulldozing of public housing projects, the closure of Charity Hospital, the major public hospital providing health care to low-income people in New Orleans, that was closed. And that all happened when people were physically absent from the city. So it was really, really hard to resist. And people did try to resist in New Orleans, but it was almost impossible, to be honest with you. And, you know, there were small demonstrations outside of the housing projects while they were being demolished, but people had not yet moved back to the city, so they couldn't defend their schools and they couldn't defend their homes. In in Puerto Rico, there has been this mass displacement, as Elizabeth mentioned, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. Once again, we don't know how many people because the government of Puerto Rico isn't counting. The U.S. government isn't counting. They're deliberately really masking these numbers. But there are still millions of Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico who have been able to resist. And I think it's quite extraordinary that even without power, without electricity, I mean, Elizabeth and I were at this historic meeting that happened in February in a community called Mariana, where a couple hundred organizers, activists from many different sectors representing 60 organizations came together in a community that still didn't have water, that still didn't have power, though they'd put up solar panels, and they had a remarkable community kitchen. They came together to not just resist disaster capitalism, but advance a people's platform. And I'd love to mention that all the royalties for this book, the Battle for Paradise, go to this new coalition, which is called Junta Gente, which people can read about at their website, juntagente.org. And that is the biggest difference, and I think it represents you know, a lot that Elizabeth can speak to better than me about the deep history of resistance in Puerto Rico, but also movements learning from one another and an evolution.
We're hearing about 50. Sorry, Elizabeth.
No, go on.
We're hearing about 50,000 home mortgages that might be in foreclosure, and we've been talking about resistance and work with various activist groups pushing back. Are there any organizations trying to help people keep their homes?
There are organizations on the island that are trying to do that, and then there is in the United States a number of organizations that are working to provide resources. A lot of the folks on the island are working with folks here. Got land trusts buying up properties. People are being pushed out of their homes. So there is the issue of folks losing their mortgages and losing their homes. And so the issue of land trusts is a big one. But people are trying not only to keep people in Puerto Rico, but are trying to get the folks here who are already here in the United States to move back so that their land isn't taken over.
And that's, of course, tied to this austerity agenda, right? Because a lot of what has driven people out of Puerto Rico, I mean, there are many reasons, but some of it is that the schools where their kids go to school are being shut down.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Hari Kondabolu. I've been speaking with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalists, along with Elizabeth Jean-Pierre, Executive Director of UpRose and Co-Chair of the Climate Justice Alliance. Thank you both again for joining me today.
Thank you, Hari.
Thank you for having
Elizabeth.
Us.